Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, joining you on this wonderful Wednesday morning, March 26th. It's going to be another toasty one in the old Pueblo out there. 90 degrees the high today, huh? I think we got to 96 yesterday, Matt.
96 was the number, yes.
Unbelievable special for this time of year, but we love it. In the restaurant business, this is great patio weather at 7, 8, and 9 p.m. when we need it to be nice outside. Right. So bringing up all kinds of neat things in hospitality this week, I've got in studio special guest, local entrepreneur, Mr. Justin Harris, back, an alumni of both Wake Up Tucson and The Morning Voice. Welcome back, Justin.
Thanks, Grant. Appreciate you having me back on, and congratulations on the new time slot.
Thanks. We're excited to be here. 7 to 9 a.m. is a pretty cool way to get to join in local Tucsonans on their morning drive, right, on your commute to work when you are caffeinating up. The Morning Voices every day, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. And today on Food for Thought, Justin, let's talk about a top four things that are going on in the hospitality industry in Tucson. Looks like the Arizona Inn is for sale, huh?
Yeah, beautiful property. I mean, it's pretty crazy. I mean, seeing all these, you know, kind of businesses pop up for sale, but that is it's a Tucson staple, and hopefully somebody's able to step in and take it over.
JLL Hotels has that property listed. I've reached out to JLL just to get an idea on the price over here. The internet is speculating and bubbling over about what that cost could be for this 89-room historic property, right? Been around since 1930, so 95 years over there on Campbell. Like, what a doozy on Elm. And what an important property for Tucson, quite frankly, too. So hopefully there could be a buyer that would be interested in not redeveloping, but instead just continuing that culture of excellence that they've had at the Arizona Inn on a property so close to both the university, University Medical Center, and just Midtown in general on Campbell. And boy, does Campbell just continue to be the restaurant row of Tucson. Not just saying it because Union Hospitality Group happens to be at River and Campbell, but gosh, is there just a lot of activity happening on the Campbell corridor. To begin with, it looks like Oh My Chicken is opening up their second location on Campbell. This is going to be Campbell and Glen, the former location of the Brush Fire Barbecue, located just south of that new build-out where the original Chop Shop is. This is location number two for Oh My Chicken. They happen to be in Park Mall as well, too. And get this, it's a Korean fried chicken place. Those listeners of The Morning Voice over here might remember that just last week, we had Matt Quick on from Banchan Chicken, who had opened up his second location. He's got one over at Tanga Verde and Pima. A second one just opened up on 4th Avenue and University. And so there is a run on Korean chicken happening over here, Justin. Have you had a chance to have a Korean chicken yet?
I haven't. I've had some good Korean barbecue, but I haven't been one of the chicken places. But you tend to see kind of these, you know, for lack of a better term, fads pop up. And, you know, you'll get three or four, you know, kind of establishments with the same concept there. But looking forward to trying it. And you're right. I mean, Campbell's really turning into a real hotspot for new food.
We have gone from zero to four Korean chicken places in the last year. So, like, this is a pretty hot category over here. Is this the new cupcake store of 2025? I don't know, but keep an eye out for the opening of Oh My Chicken right down the block over here at Campbell and Glen. Right up the street on Campbell, even more happenings going on. Sure, we talked last week and the week before about the original Nico's space, right, turning into a Dutch Bros. Construction has started at that corner, the northwest corner of Campbell and Fort Lowell, and they're working on the dirt work right now for that one. As well, too, like just down the street from there, the Fabrics and Go store that had been there for many decades just got bought by Larson Baker and is bladed in the last 2 weeks. Lots of dirt work going on there, and that's going to be a burger concept is my understanding as well, too. Looking forward to what pops up over there, but right next to it as well, too, the former Pastiche space has construction going on, and a little birdie tells me that's going to be an upscale sports pub called The District, right? Many beers on tap. Those might remember Pastiche. Pat Connor passed away a number of years ago. It went through a series of ownership changes, culminating in kind of an unfortunate end with the owner of Pastiche being arrested for murder and drug distribution. And so they're kind of working to get the stains off of that location, both literally and proverbially over here, and should be opening up inside of a month or two, a local sports pub called The District. So Campbell just has so many things going on right now. It's pretty unbelievable to see the amount of development happening on this Midtown thoroughfare. What also opened up this week was a Huevo Mexican Grill and the former Magpie space on 4th Avenue. Not quite sure of the ownership group of that one yet, but another sit-down, full-service Mexican restaurant with booze. This one popped up on the Avenue just in time, not shockingly, for the 4th Avenue Street Fair, which was this weekend. Pretty much a perfect time to get open over there. And my understanding is, Matt, that the Caruso's got open back up this weekend as well,
oh,
too.
Oh, good. They were able to work that out.
Yeah, there's
the roof issues.
Right. Quite a bit of issues on that old building. And of course, you know, for 4th Avenue, if you're not open on the street fair, like, you have made a heinous, heinous, grave business mistake over there in some capacity, because that is absolutely the highest of high season, this March or April street fair activity on the Avenue. Like, this is where it absolutely is going down. And so the former Magpie space has gotten transformed with new ownership. That just opened up about 2 weeks ago as well, too. So again, happy to bring you all the local hot restaurant gossip over here on the Morning Voice. All kinds of new things going on the top of the news with respect to restaurants and liquor laws and laws about such things such as THC or hemp products, right? A new D2 dispensary is opening up on Oracle Road. We're going to have Mo Asnani in a couple weeks. I've talked to Mo, and he'd like to break down that collaboration. There's a drive-through as well, too, at this point. So you're getting drive-through cannabis in Tucson coming on here. And he's going to come on the show in just a couple weeks and talk about that one. But Attorney General Chris Mays came out in just the last 48 hours and has talked about hemp-derived products that are available for sale right now in Tucson at Total Wine that have a THC content in them. And they're legal, at least according to Total Wine's opinion, on federal law because of the Farm Bill in 2018 that allows products that have a little bit, and by little bit I mean less than 0.3%, of THC content in them, but derived from hemp, are existing in this unregulated Wild West right now. There are House bills out there currently, as we speak, in the state of Arizona, looking to regulate these products. Are they treated like alcohol? Are they treated like cigarettes? Are they treated like weed? Who takes care of these? Well, right now, there is absolutely zero law. As California just began to regulate these products in the last year, entire truckloads of them made their way from California across state lines into Arizona, where we're not regulating them. Can you buy a product like this in a bar right now? Can I legally serve you 3 craft beers, but then a couple of hemp-derived products as well, too?
That's where it goes, yeah.
Turns out, Matt, it's legal at the moment for restaurants to do so. Ah. However, it's not insurable. Talk to your insurance agent, right? And they might have a slightly different conversation about what you can do with that. But Attorney General Chris Mays just put out a ruling that said, you've got to get these things off of your shelves, and has given a deadline of April 24th for businesses to clean up their act and remove these products.
She's going to send you a reminder if caught. I just found that amusing.
Yes, I get a few nasty grams and reminders from Attorney General Chris Mays at times. I know you may be shocked by this one over here. I think I got a deposition coming up with her in another week on that egg lawsuit. But they are working on cleaning up this THC, hemp-derived products right now, sitting on restaurant and bar shelves. And we're looking forward in the industry to seeing what happens in these decisions. Think of the restaurant laws where you have to sell at least 40% food. Do the THC products count as food like sodas do? Or does this stack up as an alcohol sale? Is this 40% just intoxicants in general as opposed to just alcohol? The truth is right now, nobody knows. And so the big purveyors, the Young's Market, the Southern Wine and Spirits, the Quench Hensleys of the world, are arguing right now that these products need to be regulated in the same way that alcohol is. And they need to be distributed by, get this, not shockingly, the exact same people that distribute it to you with their monopoly or oligopoly, depending on your point of view of the universe. And so there's going to be all kinds of legislation happening on these products inside of the next calendar year. We're going to bring on Mo Asnani in a couple weeks to talk about not just those products, but that industry again in general, and give us a pretty neat update. But when we come back after the break, Justin and I are going to meet with John Slattery, Desert Forager, a guy who knows a thing or two about alternative beverages. He's got a really cool prickly pear product. He does tepache. He does all kinds of neat beverages. John Slattery, Justin Harris, and Grant Kruger. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 AM, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, joined with special guest host, Mr. Justin Harris, live from the KVOI studios. At the break, we were talking about alternative beverages, Justin, right? Some THC hemp-derived products that may or may not be legal in the state of Arizona. But Justin and I have brought in a special guest today, Mr. John Slattery from Desert Forager, who's got his own beverages as well, too. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So tell us a little bit about Desert Forager. What are you guys doing over here?
Yeah, despite that intro, I don't have any THC products, but focus on prickly pear. So what I've been doing as a forager for the last 20, 25 years in this area is focusing on what we have available as natural resources in terms of wild plant foods. And prickly pear has stood out from the very beginning alongside other food plants like mesquite. But prickly pear is locally abundant, so I've been creating products with that to offer to the community.
That's pretty awesome. Everybody thinks about farm to table, right? And this idea that we would use locally sourced ingredients. But it's a little easier in, say, Northern California, where you're located next to farms that have an abundance. The desert, while certainly having an abundance, has alternative products, a little bit different than what we might have been used to from, say, Northern California or the Midwestern United States, no?
Yeah, for sure. And it's just my orientation when I arrived here, back here about 25 years ago, I'd been studying agroforestry in Brazil. And I was accustomed to eating off the land and farming and gathering wild plant foods. And when I came back here, I wanted to know what do we have that's locally available to eat? And that just started a huge exploration for me.
So why don't we start by breaking down what a prickly pear is for some of our guests? It happens to be winter time here in southern Arizona. So we may have some visitors that may not be even familiar with that nomenclature. Break it down for us, John.
Yeah, so prickly pear is the common name for a cactus. It's in the Opuntia genus in the cactus family. And so that's scientific nomenclature for the particular class of plant that it is, but it's the paddle-shaped cactus that is found all over the Southwest. In fact, it's all over North America into Canada. Every single state in the contiguous 48 has a species of prickly pear to it. But we're in sort of an epicenter of prickly pear abundance. And so on the Mexican flag, for example, you see an eagle perched on a prickly pear with a snake in its beak and talons. And so that's a emblem of the Mexican nation as well. And so we're not at the epicenter in all of Americas, but further down into Mexico, it's abundant. So it's been a part of Mexican culture for eons and mostly cultivated. People do eat it in the wild, but here we have an abundance of wild prickly pear, and it's the fruit that I gather. And so people may be accustomed to the fruit or what they call the nopales, which is a vegetable, you could say, in Mexican cuisine that is available in local grocery stores. And that season is actually coming up right now. But for me, it's the wild prickly pear. So it's one of those wildflowers that people fall in love with when they come to visit Tucson in the Sonoran Desert in springtime, late March into April. The deserts can be full, probably not this year because it's been so dry, but deserts can be full with prickly pear flowers.
So are all prickly pears basically wild, or are they commercially cultivated in the same way that agave might be, right? Where the Weber blue agave is, of course, grown, you know, in sort of a monoculture in the states of Jalisco and Tamaulipas and Michoacan and whatnot. Or is it all just wild caught stuff?
No, in fact, the cultivated prickly pear is very common in Mexico. And here in Tucson, for example, in Phoenix and elsewhere in the Southwest, you'll see landscaped prickly pear, the mostly spineless variety. And so that is a cultivated variety, often referred to as the Burbank, Luther Burbank. I think it was involved with cultivating that. And then you also have, people are landscaping wild ones as well, but these are cultivated as a food plant, primarily for those pads or the nopales, which is the vegetable. So I'm focused on the wild ones, which is the fruit to me is a much better fruit for juice. But in Mexico, they cultivate them for the fruit as well. And there's slews of different, probably dozens of different kinds of fruit that will be eaten out of hand as a peeled fruit in Mexico.
Do the colors change the properties? Like, is this substantively different if it's wild caught versus farmed?
Yeah, there's tremendous variety in either. And prickly pear are known botanically for being highly promiscuous. So they will exchange genetic material freely.
Whoa, that might be talking about my guest host over here, Justin Harris. But we're talking prickly pears. All right.
A little crossover there. But I can go to a locale here nearby in our area and where the botanist may recognize two, maybe three species or just subspecies. And I could find about eight to different types of fruits by color, size, taste, maybe even texture. And the ripening frequency or the schedule of ripening, I should say. So there's what I've said to friends over the years is that prickly pear could be taken in the degrees of grapes and olives, for example, highlighting the soils, the types of soils that you could get certain qualities of fruits and isolating favorable qualities and elevating that to a much higher level than what we have naturally occurring.
So what you're saying is prickly pear can basically have a terroir in the same way that wine or agaves do, or even whiskey to a certain degree.
And that it does. And it's really just a matter of us discovering that and then highlighting per our choice what we would like.
That's so interesting. I had no idea. So this product can grow all the way up to Canada? You're telling me there's Canadian prickly pear right now?
Yeah, and it's marginal. You know, that's the truth, is that it's marginal in terms of its abundance and the size of the fruit and the amount of fruit in all of these other areas. And that's one reason why it's so exceptional here, is because it is locally abundant and it produces prodigious amounts of fruit. From here to maybe West Texas is like the prime prickly pear for wild prickly pear production.
So you're telling me we're not going to see Canadian tariffs anytime on their prickly pear products coming into the United States? It's not as desirable.
We don't have to worry about that just yet.
Right on. Great news for a prickly pear over here. We're talking to John Slattery from Desert Forager. John's written books about this topic over here as well, too, and has a beverage line associated with prickly pear as well, too. Correct, John?
Yeah. The beverage line...
I don't understand.
The beverage line came out of it's Desert Forager is the name of my business, and that was an offshoot of my original business, Desert Tortoise Botanicals, which I started in 2005 as an herbalist. And I kind of got tired of only addressing the therapeutic or medicinal qualities of our plants, and I wanted to highlight what I was interested in also is the flavors that are available in the landscape. And that came up in a time when foraging was just starting to gain some traction, barely. Most people were still thinking about it in a survival sense, like what can I eat out here, you know, when all's gone to hell in a handbasket and I've got nothing left, or drop out of an airplane and how do I survive? Whereas there's actually so much to explore in terms of robust flavors that can add a lot of variety and nuance, as well as nutrition and just the experience of, as you mentioned, terroir to your local landscape. So Desert Forager has been highlighting that exclusively on prickly pear, even though there's so much more, there's just so much that I can do with prickly pear. So I've settled there for now.
Well, it's got a beautiful color, right? The fruit, like a flavor characteristic that works in jams. You see it, of course, in local restaurants as probably a prickly pear margarita more than just about anything else, right?
Yeah.
And you're rolling your eyes a bit over there for the radio guests. Is that not the way you like to see prickly pear depicted?
No. It's just the thought that occurs to me because, I started on more of the obscure end of the spectrum with the products. I still don't really make a jam. I did begin to make a syrup. And so when I was researching that a couple of years ago, see what the marketplace was offering, the prickly pear products had pictures of prickly pear on the label, but no ingredients. And there was no prickly pear in the ingredients. It was just color and corn syrup.
Oh my goodness. So there's fake prickly pear jellies and things going on over here. A counterfeit market.
So, there's prickly pear. There's so much you can do with prickly pear because it's like a colored liquid. You know, it doesn't have a lot of sugar to it. It doesn't have a really strong flavor. It's mildly sweet, mildly sour, has a little bit of watermelon or cucumber or maybe even strawberry or cherry or melon flavors, depending on the varieties.
Okay, very cool. So basically, we're doing prickly pear all wrong in the southwestern United States, is what you're telling me right now.
I just think, yeah, we just touched the tip of the iceberg. It's great. That's probably one of the most common things that people would be familiar with as a forager, like, and their grandmother made it, their aunt makes it, where they go out in the summer and pick the prickly pear and make a bunch of jam or jelly or maybe syrup. So that's fantastic. Prickly pear has a lot of health benefits, so maybe we can get into that later. But I was just... Yeah, I was exploring shrub syrups and then later fermentations and so many other possibilities with prickly pear.
So is this safe? Like somebody could basically pick a prickly pear right now and eat it? There's no cooking necessary. There's no sanitization. Like, is this dangerous? Can you hurt yourself if you're not careful? Besides for the spines, of course.
No, I think the potential for harm is very low. And, you know, like anything, it takes some getting acquainted to what you're working with to really know what you're doing. And in reality, I think most people don't, even who use prickly pear regularly, don't really know when to gather it. Because there's no instruction, and you might just think, well, it's red, so it must be ripe. And most of the people that I speak with about what they know as the flavor speaks to how soon or how early they gather it and don't have maybe never even tasted a fully ripe prickly pear.
Very interesting. Well, let's take a quick break over here on The Morning Voice. We're talking all things prickly pear with the desert forager, Mr. John Slattery and Justin Harris. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Some very cool tunes there by Matt Neely Esquire putting it on for us for The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m. I am your host, Grant Kruger. We're joined live in the KVOI studios by entrepreneur Mr. Justin Harris and fellow entrepreneur Mr. John Slattery, desert forager. He's written books about local flora over here, including the prickly pear, and we've been talking all things prickly pear. Welcome back, John.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we were talking about the products of Desert Forager. I wanted to mention a couple of the other products that we make exclusively with our locally wild harvested raw fresh frozen fruit juice from the local prickly pear. And one of them actually is the lead product, the first one that I made over a decade ago, is the shrub syrup. So a lot of people hear shrub and they think, what do you mean prickly pear? Is that a shrub? I thought it was a cactus. Well, it's not shrub in the English sense. It's a derivation of the Arabic word sharab, which means syrup. And so that goes back millennia. And it was a fruit preservation technique in the Middle East. And some countries there still utilize this, and it could be a mixture of fruit and sugar and vinegar. And so the English recovered that in the Victorian era, and shrubs were a very common drink in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And then it got revitalized by bartenders in the last couple decades. So I caught on to that, and I thought, well, this would be great. First, I started with prickly pear vinegar that I made myself. But then my friend Tom Alfonso, I got some of his aged white balsamic vinegar from Italy, from his shop there at St. Philip's Alfonso's. And everyone that I had sample that one, they said, oh, hands down, that's the best because the flavor of that vinegar is so excellent. So all of my shrub syrups are prickly pear, our local prickly pear, paired with another fruit juice, often local, and that aged white balsamic vinegar. And that makes great mocktails and cocktails just over sparkling water. It's super refreshing.
I love it. Sounds delicious. So at the break, we were talking about other beverages that you make. And of course, at the top of the hour, our topic was some alternative beverages and the various rules that go around regulating that. There's a fermented pineapple product called tepache from Mexico. And I understand that you guys are doing a unique form of tepache as well, too. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So when I say it's prickly pear tepache, most people kind of tilt their head and say, oh, I thought that was pineapple. Well, I read a book years ago called Más Allá del Pulque from Mexico. They talk about all the different fermentations that came from either wild or cultivated fruits. And so in addition to colonche, which is like a wine or beer form of prickly pear in the south of Mexico, they also made tepache from it. And I've since met people from Sonora who add prickly pear fruit juice from the wild to their pineapple tepache. So what I was playing with, I wasn't quite sure like what the lineage of that was, but I was just doing it on ambient microorganisms. So what was in the air? I wasn't even inoculating with whole fruit, meaning how you add the organisms that create the ferment. And so I was doing that way for a couple years, just experimenting. And then I decided, why don't I use these water kefir grains? Well, that was actually after the fact that I read that book, Más Allá del Pulque, where Swiss researchers went to southern Mexico in the 1890s, and they found this drink called tibi, that the Mexicans were making at the time. And they gathered organisms off of the prickly pear somehow, or off of the fruit that was fermenting. And they, the tibicos they brought back to Switzerland, they studied them, they researched them, identified all the bacteria and such in there and the yeast. And then years later, if you would have, say, been traveling in Lucerne, stop into someone's house, cottage in the mountains, and they might serve you a cup of tibi, that they called it.
So it made its way all the way from Mexico to Lucerne, Switzerland?
It was common. Yeah, I just know that was a region where it was very common. But until the World Wars, where they started to lose their access to, say, lemons and figs and certain things that they used in this drink customarily, that fell out of favor. But It was considered a quote unquote myth that prickly pear that the tibicos were actually water kefir grains. Some listeners maybe have heard of water kefir grains. Well, the water kefir grains were those tibicos that the Swiss researchers brought to Switzerland, and they eventually became rebranded as water kefir grains because kefir is from the Caucasus region, and that was fermented dairy. And then water kefir was to say that it didn't require dairy. You could do it with any sugary liquid, like water with raisins or whatever, or honey. And somewhere in between World War II era and, say, the 60s or 70s, when that came over here, it was rebranded and brought back over. But nobody knew, and everyone online that I saw doubted that it actually came from Mexico. But I had a client who is from Switzerland, a researcher, scientist, and she found the papers in Swiss German from the 1890s that had never been translated into English, and she confirmed for me that that's where they got those organisms, and they did bring them to Switzerland. So that's the full circle of that story that I didn't realize until after I'd been making it.
Wild, John. That's so interesting. So where can somebody get a Tapache product right now? Like, can I try a Desert Forager prickly pear Tapache product today?
Yeah, you can. You can order from us directly online. We don't have a walk-in retail shop, but we have local pickup. We're located near Broadway and Campbell. You just visit our website, desertforager.com. And then we currently have one purveyor, the Food Conspiracy Co-op on 4th Avenue. But we're looking to expand and increase production this summer. And so there will be more places to purchase come summer, including our own retail space.
Very cool. Now, do those Tapache products have alcohol in them? Is it because of the fermentation process? Is this an alcoholic beverage?
Yeah, so that's called a SCOBY, the microbes. So it's a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeasts. So the bacteria consume, the yeast consume sugar that produces alcohol. The bacteria consume the alcohol, predominantly the vast majority of it, and produce acids, which makes it a sour beverage. So there's a minimal amount of alcohol that's inherent in that process, less than 0.5%, let's say.
And so those sours, that's like the lactobacillus, to geek out here with you on that?
Yes, there are some lactobacillus varieties and maybe even some Brettanomyces. It does fluctuate because it's not a highly controlled environment and we can pull things in from the atmosphere. But it's all local and it confers, this is a really interesting thing about, I'll say briefly, bacteria has this capacity, what's called horizontal gene transfer, where bacteria from the environment, they have information from the environment. When you ingest it, they can educate your gut bacteria on what they know about the environment simply by bumping into each other. Like, it doesn't require generations to pass this knowledge down. It's called horizontal gene transfer. So we can get downloads from our local environment by consuming locally fermented food products.
Wild. We are getting deep over here on The Morning Voice with Justin Harris and John Slattery, the Desert Forager. Do you think that there's a hope to maybe get these into, say, like restaurant cocktail programs in some capacity? Could a Tapache be used in a Mexican restaurant's cocktail menu?
I think that would be a fantastic idea. I have had a number of bars downtown over the years utilizing our shrub syrups for signature cocktails, primarily because of the color, as you point out. Vibrant pink purple color of the prickly pear, but the Tapache adds yet another layer to that because of its a stronger flavor and the strong acids that are present in that.
Right, and so there's a lot more to this than just the coloring agent of prickly pear, is what you're saying.
So much more. Prickly pear actually has a tremendous amount of healing potential as well. I've had people recover from type 2 diabetes, lower their blood pressure, heal musculoskeletal injuries and chronic pain. Prickly pear is an unsung hero of therapeutic, in my opinion.
This sounds like something we should be perhaps exploring a little bit more, no?
Most certainly. It's far past time that we should have been, in my opinion. I've been working on this for 20 years, but I'm kind of a quiet voice in the background. But I see so much potential because it is abundant in our area. It's just what the landscape has given us.
But John, you've written a couple books on this topic as well, too. Like, what are the names of these books? Where can our listeners find your books?
Yeah, my books, Southwest Foraging was the first book. It's by Timber Press, and then also by Timber Press, Southwest Medicinal Plants. Those are both on my website, deserttortoisebotanicals.com, or anywhere you want to purchase books from. Local bookshop would be great. So, and you can also check them out at the library. Local libraries all carry copies of them as well.
Very cool. He's an author, right? He's a botanical specialist over here as well, too. This is John Slattery, the Desert Forager. We're going to take a quick break over here. We've got one more segment with John and Justin coming up on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on 10:30 a.m. You're home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m., we're bringing you local news and conversation. Miss Lydia Aranda on Mondays. We've got Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council and his engagement hour on Tuesdays. On Wednesdays, you get me and sometimes Justin, and we're talking all things local news, restaurants, hospitality, a little bit of politics thrown in there as well, too. On Thursdays, Mr. Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley and his Wonder Hours, bringing you neat things happening at the University of Arizona. We are The Morning Voice. We've got one more segment on The Morning Voice over here with Mr. John Slattery, the Desert Forager. And he's been educating us on all things prickly pear. We are really behind the times over here on this product, huh, John?
Well, yeah, I think so from my perspective, but there's lots of potential still moving forward.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, John, look at your website, man. It looks like you got, you know, quite a bit of products either on sale or sold out. So it looks like, you know, business is good, which is great to see for a local business owner. I was just kind of curious, for a customer kind of getting into prickly pear for the first time, being myself, I'd love to try some of these delicious products. I mean, what would you recommend for somebody who knows nothing about your products and what, you know, is wanting to try one of these things for the first time?
Yeah, aside from the prickly pear syrup that everybody loves for margaritas, I think a great entry is our prickly pear limeade or prickly pear chia lemonade. The prickly pear chia lemonade was the original drink, and some people didn't really care for chia seeds in their drink, and or they wanted it a bit sweeter. So then I created the prickly pear limeade, which has no chia seeds and is a bit sweeter and has a little more citrus. They're both fantastic, really refreshing, and probably one of the best things for preventing heat exhaustion and replenishing electrolytes and protecting your body from overheating when you're out in the desert, exercising, working, whatever you're doing.
Just another one of those health benefits.
Yes, for sure.
And so we can get those products right now at the food co-op on 4th Avenue?
You can get those at the food co-op, correct. And you can purchase if you stop in for a local pickup at our shop.
Very cool. And where's that shop again located at, Jen?
We're actually on South Plumer. It's not a retail space, but if you order online, you can set up a time to pick up. But we're, South Plumer near Broadway and Campbell.
Yeah, there's the Campbell Avenue again, yet again. I keep talking about it over here, but I feel like Campbell Avenue is just becoming the restaurant row of Tucson over there. Hey, do you got any favorite local restaurants? Like, what are some of your faves over here?
Oh, man. My wife and I ate at Bata a couple of months ago. It's like, hands down, probably the best meal we've ever had.
Yeah, they do a great job at that one downtown over there.
2.5 hours, and it was incredible.
A lot of accolades over there as well, too, for sure. Yeah. What can local restaurants do to potentially get your product on their shelves or in their cocktails?
Yeah, they can reach out to me directly, john@desertforager.com, and I'm always looking to develop new relationships and help people create unique products that have a vibrancy from our local desert. And I've worked with several businesses over the last decade, and their customers are always really happy with whatever we can provide.
So you were saying that there's other products out there that in the desert that are both edible, delicious, you know, could keep you alive if dropped in on a helicopter. What else is out there besides just prickly pear?
So I didn't mention yet, I do a foraging course. It's called Introduction to Foraging in the Sonoran Desert, where I take people on a tour from March to November, immersion in the landscape. And we cover all the major food plants of the Sonoran Desert, and we cover approximately 100 different wild edible plants in the Sonoran Desert. But the major ones would be prickly pear fruit, saguaro fruit, mesquite beans, choya flower buds, Palo Verde beans, and for me, acorns is at the top of the list. We have locally landscaped acorns that would provide if we focused on them between Phoenix and Tucson and did a consciously implemented system of gathering and processing for food, maybe like 10% of the of the food needs of the population.
No way. And all this is available right now in the Sonoran Desert, and we basically just don't know anything about it, huh?
Well, you know, few do. And it, of course, was the order of the day some time ago, even amongst an agriculturally oriented people. They were agricultural hunters and gatherers and have been, you know, forever in this landscape. The Sonoran Desert is considered quite an abundant place for food foraging because of the diversity of food and the extensive length of the seasons. You can get multiple seasons out of a year. But really, we're coming up into the prime season, which is May and June, is where a lot of things hit their peak for ripeness. Whereas the prickly pear is later on. It's in the late summer, early autumn.
Does that happen because it has to flourish after the rainy season, I would assume, like post-monsoon season, to swell up with water?
Yeah, it takes advantage of both the winter and the summer rainy season. And if we don't get a winter rainy season, then we probably don't get much of any prickly pear fruit, which is what happened a few years ago.
How do you think this season has turned out to be?
It's probably going to be next to nothing, is my guess. We'll see. You know, there's a long-standing, centuries-old knowledge base from what I've read that if you have very limited winter rain, you have very limited prickly pear fruit production. But it bodes, on the other side of that, it bodes well for the columnar cacti, i.e. the saguaro fruit or pitaya down in Sonora, and all the other types, sabueso and cenita. There's so many different types of columnar cacti in the Sonoran Desert. We just have the saguaro here because we're at the northern end.
No, it makes total sense. So where can we find out about these desert courses? If Justin and I wanted to take this and learn a little bit more about the desert, like where can we rock out with you on that?
Yeah, so all my courses are listed at johnjslattery.com. And there, so I have drop-ins available for the remaining sessions that I call them in the foraging course, the Intro to Foraging course. So you can find those there on that website. And then I also have an online course that I'm developing on foraging in the Southwest. And then I currently have a Vitalist Herbalism online community as well, that there's a cohort going through till August, September. And then I'll take in a new cohort. So I'm always doing something.
It sounds like it. This is amazing. What a great segment to spend some time with such a knowledgeable expert about product like this. Break it down one more time for our listeners on where they can find information about Desert Forager.
Yeah, desertforager.com. You go there and you can find out about our products. If you have any questions or you'd like to order something specific that you don't see, just email me and I'll help you out. I also have Desert Tortoise Botanicals, which is an extensive line of herbal products that I started out with making only what I gathered myself from the local desert and mountains. And then John J. Slattery is where you find out about my courses. I also have a Substack page that expand a little bit more on my thoughts and ideas there. And then Instagram, you know, I'm there on occasion. But best place to get my course is at johnjslattery.com. And if you're interested in the private community, you'll see some more information about that.
Super amazing. Well, I don't know about Jasmine. I am really looking forward to trying some of this both prickly pear syrup and this prickly pear lemonade over there as well, too. Like, this sounds absolutely fascinating.
Regrettably, I didn't bring some for you. I'll have to come back.
We'll have to have another segment over here. We could start that morning with some prickly pear margaritas over here. It's been an absolutely fascinating hour with you, Mr. Slattery. John J. Slattery from the Desert Forager joining us on The Morning Voice. Thank you again for spending part of your Wednesday with us. And listeners, don't go anywhere. Justin Harris and I have all kinds of local news and sports and politics to talk about on the next hour of The Morning Voice. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Justin Harris on 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. This is Hour 2. I am your host, Grant Kruger, joined live in the KVUI studios with Mr. Justin Harris, local entrepreneur. So many things are happening right now in Tucson. This is still just our highest of high season, but almost nothing can be more impactful right now than what's currently happening in the city of Tucson at 10 o'clock this morning. There are funeral services for former Congressman Raul Grijalva, at the St. Augustine Church starting at 10 a.m. There's going to be a host of high-ranking Democrat speakers there. It looks like we're going to get Nancy Pelosi. It looks like we're getting AOC. There's a former Secretary of the Interior. All kinds of high-ranking Democrats to pay some final tributes to a local Tucson congressman. Of course, Tucson police are recommending that you don't go downtown this morning. I'm not so sure that that's different than some other days that what they might not be recommending over here, Justin. But this is going to really change the face of local politics here, huh? It looks like we'll probably be getting an announcement from Adelita Grijalva in the next day or so on her candidacy for Congressional District Number 7. And if she does that, she has to step down from the Pima County Board of Supervisors to run for that position. And on top of it, it looks like current Secretary of State, the number two position in the entire state of Arizona, Adrian Fontes, may be announcing his candidacy as well, too, for that position. And so he would have to step down to take that seat. And we just got the announcement a couple days ago that local Democrat politician Daniel Hernandez has announced his candidacy for that position. So we are setting ourselves up for a Fontes, Grijalva, Hernandez clash of the titans over here. This is a local Godzilla versus Mothra style of politics for sure. And the ripple effects are going to continue for possibly years here as the various seats, whether it's Secretary of State or Board of Supervisors, have to step down. And then we've got replacements for those positions as well. Do you got a favorite in that race, Justin?
I mean, I was kind of interested to see. I think there was a fourth name kind of being tossed around there. Our current mayor, I think, was also considered for that position, if I'm not mistaken.
She's announced, though, that she doesn't seem to have an intention to want to leave Tucson. Perhaps it was the failing of Proposition 414 right around this timing, or perhaps she's got something else in mind, but she's said that she's not going to run at the moment. There are a number, I think there's 9 Democrat candidates in total, and 5 Republicans for this, including the last candidate that ran just in November, Gutierrez, right?
Daniel Gutierrez
could probably just break out his campaign signs from last election and just restake them back into the ground, saving a few bucks over here as well, too. Local restaurateur Jorge Rivas from Sammy's Mexican Grill on North Oracle Road has announced his candidacy. And there's a number of other candidates as well, too, for this position. So as soon as these funeral services are over, by noon or 1 o'clock today, we're going to be staring down the barrel of a number of campaign announcements over here that may affect the political landscape of Southern Arizona for the next decade. So if Adelita Grijalva steps down, the Board of Supervisors can announce a replacement. They've got to pick from the same political party of which she was. Not shocking with a 4-1 advantage there, or 3-1 in her absence. It wouldn't be shocking that that would have happened either way. And she won't get, or whomever this appointment is, won't get the opportunity to live out the full term. Because there's 3.5 years left in this cycle, they'll have to have a special election in 2026, either way, to fill that seat. The local city council and Board of Supervisors have taken this practice of appointing people who had said that they were not going to run for the subsequent elections. It's not statute by any means. This isn't required by law. But this is what they've been doing, and it wouldn't surprise me to see that one happen again. Rumor on the street says that Andres Cano, former state lawmaker, is sort of the heir apparent for that particular appointment. And he's probably even a little further left of center than Adelita as well, too. And so the Board of Supervisors may take an even more decided turn to left of center, because when you think of what, you know, Jen Allen and Matt Hines bring to the table, Adelita Grijalva may be your moderate Democrat along with Rex Scott on that Board of Supervisors right now. And so we may be losing a moderate and having the board even move further to the left. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you could remind the listeners, I mean, so there's 2.5 years or 3.5 years left until the next election that would basically, you know, officially vote for that seat.
So it's 3.5 right now, but because of the way the absence would be appointed, that person would sit up until 2026 as the appointed person, and then they would either have to run, or if this sort of de facto, if you're running, you can't be appointed thing continues, there'll be a whole new candidate in 2026.
And that would be a citywide or a statewide election at that point.
So this is countywide, specifically for the Board of Supervisors. And in her particular district, which happens to be the southwestern part of Pima County Board of Supervisors.
Right. And so it's interesting when you see people start to position, you know, themselves for that seat. Again, you mentioned like an Adrian Fontes coming out of Phoenix per se. So you wonder, you know, obviously he's got the name recognition on the Secretary of State side of things, but you know, obviously, the daughter of Raul might have some better recognition, in the community. So it is interesting to see kind of how they position themselves on that, along with the plethora of other candidates they have coming in as well.
Without a doubt, and the idea that you have to vacate your seat to run for this one is sort of a unique proposition of running for Congress. What's also unique is that you don't have to live in the district. So you can be, you know, from the Phoenix metro area or from Northern Arizona. It's kind of interesting. There's been a lot of issues over the years over city council seats or even state legislative seats where the discussion about whether this person actually lives in that district or not. There was a lawsuit, if you recall, between Vince Leach and Justine Wadsack a couple of years ago after her election about whether she really was part of Legislative District 17 or not. Can you say, hey, I was crashing at a friend's pad for a while, I'm suddenly part of that? If I want to run for city politics, Justin, can I crash on your couch for 6 months?
That's debatable. I'll have to check with my HOA president on that one.
But right, yeah. There could be some significant issues. But the city has rules about residency. The county has rules about residency. The federal government actually does not. And as such, you can literally be from anywhere in the state of Arizona and run for that seat. And there is a lot of names stacking up for this particular position. And we're going to learn a lot about Southern Arizona politics in really the next 48 hours for this seat. Now, a special election has been called for this. The primaries will be on the 15th of July. And that election is going to be on September 23rd. This is statute. This has nothing to do with what we've highly criticized the city for doing, which was holding an off-cycle election for their ballot proposition 414. This just happens to do with the calendar dates of when they have to declare this particular election. So we're going to end up with, quite frankly, a pair of primaries. We're going to have a July congressional primary and then an August primary for the city council seats, right, that are coming up. There's races for city councils 3, 5, and 6. There could be primaries on either the Republican or Democrat side for those seats and a general election in November. As we've talked about many times on this show before, the city loves having these off-year and off-cycle elections, 2023, 2025, 2027. That way, there's not a lot of interest for Republicans voting in these elections. You're not getting the interesting gubernatorial race, the interest in a presidential race, which just drives all of our attention. This is sort of an apathetic voter base that goes, well, maybe I'll show up, maybe I won't. There's not any real big-ticket things on there. And quite frankly, my team may or may not win anyway, based on voter registration. And so the congressional race is going to be the 15th of July for your primary and the 23rd of September for the general.
Well, and to further that point, I mean, you know, some of them, they can require mail-in elections also. So, I mean, that kind of, you know, starts to hinder some of the turnout as well, especially when you're doing these off-cycle elections. Just another way of, again, perhaps not on purpose, but just a way, you know, that historically, you know, turns down has voters basically not turning out in quite the numbers that they could in person.
Without a doubt. But shockingly, there was over 83,000 votes cast in this Proposition 414 sales tax election, with only about 105,000 or so cast in a normal mayoral cycle that would hit on November. So really, like, you know, about a 20-25% drop on voters for a mail-in only election, but it wasn't bad. I was pleasantly surprised to see that voter turnout as high as it was. It had only been 65,000 or so for the TEP franchise agreement special election in May of 23, and we were thinking numbers might be as low as that one. And so getting up to the mid-80s showed a lot of voter interest, you know, a lot of kickback on whether or not that special sales tax election was worth it, whether our society wanted to pay an extra half cent or extra half percent, I should say, in sales tax on every purchase in the city of Tucson. And it was soundly defeated, 70% to 30%, an absolute mandate indeed. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk other local news and politics over here. There's a House bill making its way right now, a concurrent resolution that would make citizens' initiatives have to get to 60% as opposed to 50% threshold as it stands right now. We're going to talk about that and all kinds of other local Tucson news when we come back after the break. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Justin Harris on 1030 AM, The Voice, your home for local news. And welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, joining you every Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 AM, talking all things local hospitality, restaurant, business, and political news. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday mornings with us. Welcome back, Justin Harris, guest hosting for me today, helping break down some local news. We saw something interesting about city parks popping up on the news this morning, Justin. Let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah, Grant, looks like city council member Karen Ulick is suggesting she might be floating a bill here to turn some of our city parks into what they're calling help huts, using some of the city parks, some of those ramadas, into some camps to help some of our homeless.
So these are the same ramadas that you could rent from the city. I think I've rented these on a few different occasions for like my daughter's little birthday parties and whatnot, where we bring some Costco pizza and a cake or something along these lines, right? Like, these are the ramadas that we're talking about, that they're going to be homeless shelters in some capacity?
Yeah, I guess in her announcement, it talked about providing daytime aid and overnight campsites at some of our larger parks scattered across the city is kind of the initial thought.
Think about the effect that would have on families going to visit the parks. Like, if you wanted to take your little kids, your dog, to a park, you would come across somebody showering, brushing their teeth, using the bathroom in the local park. Like, this doesn't seem to be the correct use of local park facilities for me.
Yeah, I mean, it gets into a lot of the issues that you just mentioned. But I mean, you think of our city parks as somewhere that, we want to be able to bring our families to kind of get away from, the dangers of the current streets. Again, I know we talk about First and Fort Lowell all the time, but I mean, some of these intersections are starting to look pretty bad. And so, you start to think about, bringing some of these people again into our city parks and around our community, and again, specifically our little kids. And, obviously it just brings up a plethora of questions.
The whole thing becomes questionable about whether this is the appropriate use of city parks, right? That a park belongs to society, to everybody. It's part of our City of Tucson charter that we provide parks and public safety and roads. These are pretty much the only things that our city should be providing if we happen to be in the financial crisis that purportedly we are, a crisis that warranted a special election to attempt to raise our taxes to pretty much the highest sales tax of any city over 75,000 people in the entire state of Arizona. And here we are finding ways to turn our local parks into essentially homeless encampments.
Yeah, again, it's a tough issue. I mean, I don't want to sit here and just completely, rag on the homeless community. I mean, obviously it's an issue that most of our country deals with on a daily basis, and a lot of these people are have mental issues that are hard to address. And so I don't want to sit here and completely come down on them and act like we don't want any of these people anywhere near any of our community facilities. But again, it just kind of touches on the point that it doesn't really seem like the city has a great plan to address the issue overall. And so suggesting a short-term band-aid, like turning our city parks into a place that we can start, providing services for these people. Again, it obviously just raises a ton of red flags right off the bat.
No, all kinds of things to be completely concerned about here in Tucson and the Old Pueblo. One thing to be excited about in the Old Pueblo happens to be our alma mater over here, the University of Arizona Wildcats, making their way to the Sweet 16. All of Tucson is absolutely ecstatic over our basketball team right now. You will see local news media outlets doing such stories as Sweet 16 provides economic development for bars and restaurants in Southern Arizona, and the same sort of stories that happen on, say, August 7th or so when the students return every year. But this one really is a big deal, huh? Are you out making it out to Newark this year to go catch that game?
I would love to travel anywhere that the Cats are playing, especially in a Sweet 16 scenario. I know we were close to making it up to Seattle. A couple logistic things kept us from going, but there's a huge Tucson contingent. I know that went up to Seattle Seattle. We saw one of our local friends there, you know, on kind of a screenshot, you know, roaring on the crowd. And I think, you know, a lot of that same contingent is going to be traveling to Newark. Again, maybe not the most ideal destination for a spring break vacation with your kids, but obviously you got New York City right down the road. So there's, you know, probably some pretty decent attractions to also attend there on the East Coast.
Now, the U of A is a pretty significant underdog in this particular game, either 9.5 or 10 points, depending on which betting platform you're looking at right now. So it's nearly double-digit underdog against Duke. What time is that game?
I believe it's 6:40 on Thursday.
Yep, 6:40 on Thursday, right? And so everyone's excited for that one. Every local bar and restaurant, as we know it, is going to turn into a sports bar, whether you are or not, when the Wildcats are playing over here. Kind of a big deal for Tucson, and pretty exciting to see our men's basketball team continue to advance and be competitive in a world where suddenly you're starting to see the haves and the have-nots in college sports, right? At this point, all of the Sweet 16 teams, every single one is from a power conference right now. It's the first time that that's happened in the history of the NCAA tournament, that there really isn't a Cinderella in any capacity, right? First time, and it strikes me as not a coincidence that with this NIL and player compensation model, that suddenly the Cinderellas are eliminated, right? Like maybe they didn't have the financial wherewithal to compete and put teams forward with this. Can we have a professional or semi-professional sports league with 130 NCAA teams? I don't know, Justin. Like I feel that the NBA has 32 teams for a reason. Major League Baseball has approximately, you know, 30 teams for a reason. NHL, NFL, each one of these franchises is worth billions of dollars with a B. And yet they choose not to make more than 32. Why is that?
I mean, I think for the points you just pointed out, again, I mean, you know, we're obviously not experts in the matter, but I think as you start to see the conglomeration of NIL, you know, kind of take its toll, I mean, there's only so much booster money out there, you know, now corporation money willing to kind of go into the pot. So, you know, you start to look at, okay, well, where are the major donors, where are the major corporations putting their money? And again, you know, it may be a coincidence, but considering NIL is a fairly, you know, new to the market, but again, you start to see zero Cinderellas, which again is what makes March Madness, you know, such a, you know, enamored tournament. You start to see zero Cinderellas. You start to see again the number one seeds. You know, not to get, you know, too nerdy on the subject, but the number one seeds starting to be, you know, as dominant as they are. It all just kind of points to the fact that we might be starting to see NIL taking its toll and really having its effect on some of the smaller programs here in the country.
Yeah, this is the first time since the Sweet 16 officially began in 1975 that we have had only power conferences existing in that final 16 teams over here. And it makes me wonder if these smaller schools are going to be able to be competitive, not just in basketball, because at least in basketball, one or two good transcendent players could make the difference. But in football, when you've got an 80-some-odd person roster, like what it takes to field a team at the University of Arizona, you've got to be deep. You need a strong second and third string. And now the deepness isn't just in talent. It's in our wallets, right? Our pocketbooks. Do we have wealthy enough alumni donors to continue to give to the program and have them be competitive 5, 10, 15 years from now? Are there going to be 130 NCAA college football teams or 130 NCAA basketball teams? Or are they going to shrink to the right market size of approximately 30 teams, which is what all the other pro sports leagues have chosen to do?
Yeah, and again, you look at, you know, we would love to sit here and think that, you know, Tucson's a blue chip program, and I still think we're an elite program that players want to come to. Tommy Lloyd's done a good job at recruiting, but at some point, you kind of have to start to think, okay, well, you know, how much bigger is Phoenix than Tucson? How much more, money and donor money and funds are up in, you know, the Phoenix metro area? And at some point, will we start to see, I mean, obviously we had ASU have a great run in football last season. I hated to see it, but it's good for their program. It's good for the city. And again, a city like that, I mean, who's to say that they're going to, you know, start taking over sooner than later in terms of Phoenix versus Tucson rivalry?
Without a doubt. They've got deeper wallets in Phoenix, and the free market pretty much dictates that, right? You can see from economic development, a quick little restaurant nugget over here, liquor licenses, bar ones, trade for whatever somebody is willing to sell and buy them for, and they're county specific. A Series 6 bar liquor license in Arizona in Pima County right now is worth about $70,000, and that same Series 6 liquor license for Maricopa County is worth about $225,000. So that is the free market speaking right there about the value of doing business in Maricopa County versus the value of doing business in Pima County. And it worries me that we may not be able to be competitive on that level, not just like in economic development in terms of businesses and job creation, which is probably the biggest thing we should be worried about on this show, but also in terms of our beloved University of Arizona and college sports. Like, I'm worried that we may not be competitive in the future on that one as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does start to trickle down. And again, I mean, we've talked about it on the show before, but, Tucson's willingness or unwillingness, if you will, to attract jobs to Tucson and large employers, which at this point we don't really have a ton, if any. So again, you know, you're bringing in a salary base, you're bringing in, those types of donors to be willing to stay in that community, which thus trickles down to the sports programs, booster money, you know, so on and so forth. So it all intertwines, and it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Without a doubt. Well, we've got two more segments coming up. I've got Justin Harris, Grant Kruger. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 AM, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. Every Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 a.m., get a little dose of Tucson restaurant lore, gossip, and business news with me. I've got a couple more segments over here with entrepreneur Justin Harris, University of Arizona graduate. We were just discussing the exciting U of A game that's going to be happening tomorrow, 6:39 p.m., taking on the Duke Blue Devils in a rematch of the 2001 NCAA championship, where we were preseason number one and they were preseason number two, or was it vice versa? And we ended up locking horns all the way in the finals, only to lose to those guys as well.
Too soon, Grant. Too soon.
24 years after the fact, and we're still struggling on this one, huh?
Hey, they beat him by 30 points in the Elite Eight in 2014. So there were good moments in between then and now.
Without a doubt.
And we went to Duke last season, yep, and beat them, you know, in their house. Obviously, they returned the favor by coming here and beating us, but I mean, you know, I'm sure we consider it a rivalry. They probably have a little bit more important rivalries to worry about. They got, you know, North Carolina right up the street that I think they'd probably rank over us. But I mean, for us, it's just a huge rivalry, and what an honor to be able to play them in the Sweet 16. They obviously probably have the best player in college basketball currently. Probably, you know, they have probably a number one pick, and they, you know, their other guard, is probably, you know, top seven pick. So, I mean, you know, going up against that will be a tough task. But again, you look at the way we've been playing, you know, leading through the Big 12 tournament. I think probably being in the Big 12 year, Big 12 this year, has really helped us, you know, playing better competition on a week in, a week out basis. Looked great in the Big 12 tournament. Obviously, kind of fell short there in the championship game. But, you know, coming into the tournament, obviously had a great first round. And then that Oregon game was, full of some ups and downs. And I'm glad we got the win. But, you know, maybe good to get, you know, that going down 15 out of our system and, you know, be able to come into this next game, locked and loaded.
Without a doubt. And if we were successful on that Thursday and we win that game tomorrow, we'll get a Saturday game against the winner of BYU and Alabama. Now, wouldn't that be shocking to see BYU come back after the sort of difficult crowd behavior that we happen to have at McHale Center?
17th rematch of the season. How many times have they played together this year?
Right?
I know it's only a couple.
That could happen. And a difficult task for them, because Alabama's, you know, probably a top five team in the country for most of the year as well, too. But anything can happen in the tournament.
But they don't have Jimmer Fredette. And that guy, I'm still scarred by that guy, you know, lighting us up for 50 points or something a decade and a half ago or something.
I was at that game, Matt, and I'm still scarred by it.
I think I was as well.
The McHale crowd, like when they pulled Jimmer Fredette from that game with 2 minutes left, gave him a standing ovation, yeah, right? Like, and that shows how classy we can be at, yeah, McHale, right, with, yeah, BYU. And yes, we gave them a different salutation, I believe, yes, a couple of weeks ago over at McHale.
People regret they did that.
But when Jimmer Fredette scored all those points and they pulled him out of the game, McHale stood up and cheered him, because it was probably one
at
of the
best. At that point, what can you do, yeah, right? I mean,
he hit from everywhere, like a Salim Stoudemire level, making convenient rain. And so there could be that matchup on Saturday as well, too. But we've got to win first. Now, getting back into some local news and politics, we do have city council races coming up as well, too. It's not just a congressional election over here. We're having elections in 2025 for seats, or wards, I should say, 3, 5, and 6. Now, none of these wards are particularly competitive in the sense of voter registration. Significant Democrat advantages in the ward. And then, of course, our unusual ward election system where the entire city gets to vote for all 6 wards certainly makes things a challenge as well, too. What do you think about that, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to have you kind of give our listeners maybe a little bit of a brief history on, you know, kind of our unique situation, one of the, you know, kind of only ones really in the country that do it that way. But I'll just say kind of right off the top that, you know, if we could kind of get on the same page as you know, the elections that are held elsewhere, even in this state, I think it would give a much better chance to some of our other, you know, candidates. You know, you can kind of go back and look at the numbers and rework the numbers and look at how many races, you know, easily could have been affected by a change in that policy. And we could have had, you know, some much, you know, different candidates in there.
Without a doubt. So a brief, quick breakdown for our listeners over here. We've been doing a unique election system in the city of Tucson since 1929. We happen to be a charter city, and we brought in this unique system with us into Tucson becoming part of the state of Arizona. This system was originally created with racist undertones of our 1920s past, of which there were many scenarios like this, but it was really created to prevent Mexican representation in a city ward on the southwest side of Tucson, so that if they were able to muster up a candidate to win their primary in that ward, they would be washed away by the lily-white city of Tucson, preventing Mexican representation on the city council. Nearly 100 years later, this policy still exists, which is amazing to me, that often in the competitive wards 2 and 6, which, and mind you, listeners, all 6 wards have a Democrat voter advantage right now, today, in 2025. But wards 2 and wards 4 are particularly close. Certainly what we would consider to be competitive. And those candidates would stand a fighting chance if they only had the votes in the general for their individual ward. And in many cases, including in 2023, candidates have come out and won their ward, and in any other city in the United States would essentially have won that election, but instead lose because even though their constituency voted them in, the entire city votes for all 6 wards and somehow finds a way to wash them out. And so this is a policy that I would love to see changed over here. No matter where you stand politically, having a representative democracy makes an awful lot of sense. The city has gone off to say, well, because city council members represent the entire city should vote for them. And of course, my counter argument to that is, well, if the Senate votes for, you know, the entire country, how come the senators of Idaho aren't elected by the entire country? Why don't we let California and New York vote for the senators of Montana? Why not? Oh, it's because the rest of the country wouldn't represent their local interests, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, you could even bring it local. I mean, that's a great point. But I mean, you could bring it local. And I mean, if you had an issue, let's say in, you know, one of these wards, and you went, you know, perhaps it was a park setting up a homeless hut in your park, and you went to your, you know, the city council member in a different ward, they would most likely refer you back to the city council member of that other ward. So again, you know, I understand, you know, the argument, you know, or not necessarily understand it, but obviously their argument is letting the entire, you know, city vote on this. But again, you know, these council, you know, members are proud to represent their wards, and you know, there's an argument to be made that that's what the vote should be.
Without a doubt. But that being said, there's still candidates interested in these positions. It looks as if we're going to no longer have a Republican primary in Ward 6, and we're going to have a candidate run that happened to be the owner of PJ's filling station, a restaurant at 6th and Tucson. And it looks as if he's going to run for city council. And I've talked to him quite a bit to see if maybe he'd like to come on the show and talk to us about this. As well, J.L. Wittenbraker, you may know Ms. Wittenbraker from both a mayoral campaign and a Pima County Board of Supervisor campaign. And she may be running over here for Ward 3. She's collecting signatures. And I understand that there's a candidate for Ward 5 in the works as well, too. So, Matt?
And I just want to, one other characteristic about this election will be there will be two new city council members. No matter what else happens. Now, you know, different factions in the city are trying to line up their preferred candidate. So you may have people that really align with the current council majority or the current council unanimity, I'm sorry. But there will be two council members. And that's really what makes the primary races very important. Even if you are stuck with a Democratic Party representative for, say, Ward 5 or Ward 6, you know, you can still have a certain amount of inflection on the board by electing somebody who may challenge the current majority or the current unanimity.
Without a doubt. And we're doing an event actually in St. Philip's Plaza this upcoming Monday, the 31st, for such a candidate. Mr. Jesse Lugo is going to do a fundraiser over with us at River and Campbell starting at 5 p.m. out there. Should be great patio weather. He's a moderate Democrat candidate running for Ward 5, local business owner over the last 50 years here. Certainly a very, very strong candidate for city council. And he's going to do a fundraiser over in our restaurants. And we're excited to have him as well, too. I certainly salute anybody willing to take the risk to put their name out there, to be potentially slandered by the press, right? To be potentially not just badmouthed, but criticized and have your social history and life picked apart, looking for flaws in some capacity, all in the name of public service. But I bet we're going to see a little more crowded primary field on both sides of the aisles over the next few years because we've raised those salaries. No longer is the city council paid nothing more than a measly $24,000 a year with a rate in the mid-90s right now for that position. Like, suddenly, that's a job, right? That could and maybe should be a full-time job for some of these guys. And we'll talk about that when we come up after the break. We've got one more segment on the Morning Voice over here. It looks as if the TCC is going to have a renaming coming up. Rio Nuevo's got a meeting this afternoon to see if they're going to approve a potential candidate for a $2 million a year naming rights. If you've got any names for the TCC, give us a holler at 520-790-2040. You're listening to the Morning Voice with Grant Kruger and Justin Harris on 1030 AM. A little Stevie Wonder to wind up your Wednesday over here on The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, joined live back in the KVY studios with Mr. Justin Harris, local entrepreneur extraordinaire. Hey, Justin, I was just looking at the agenda for the Rio Nuevo Multipurposes Facility District because that's the kind of thing I do when I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And notice that the naming rights for Tucson Arena, i.e. the TCC, happens to be up there as well, too. And so they're looking down the barrel of a $2 million a year naming rights deal for that particular stadium. Any idea on what names that could be?
Well, you know, we were kind of joking during the break, but I mean, again, you know, I don't want to sit here and, you know, harp on the same subject. Again, kind of indicative of, you know, the lack of, you know, large business here in Tucson. I mean, again, if you were a betting man, you kind of look at, you know, some of the larger entities. I mean, I would probably, you know, place my odd favorite on, you know, possibly a TEP or something like that would make the most sense to me.
Sure. I mean, the city of Tucson, of course, looking to acquire their own electric company over here. So maybe they could name that stadium right over here. I think about, you know, Arizona Sports Enterprises and the U of A is also looking to sell the naming rights to Arizona Stadium right now. And you're talking about multi-million dollar deals. Who can afford this in the city of Tucson? What sort of local business can do this? You know, are we going to end up with the Snoop Dogg, you know, Tucson Stadium over here in some capacity? A couple of years ago, it reminds me of what happened at Miami, right? The Miami Heat Arena. There was a local Miami-based pornography company, and I won't say their name on the radio to violate FCC rules, but submitted a $10 million bid to rename the Miami Heat Stadium after this porn company. Could we end up with Raiders Reef Stadium or something like that here in Tucson? I'm a little concerned about who might be able to afford this one locally, right? Because once we get past Caterpillar and American Battery Factory that we continue to talk about over and over again, I think what we're looking at is probably a 24-hour smoke shop.
So it's not Union Hospitality Stadium. Am I jumping the gun? Am I letting the cat out of the bag?
We were thinking about it. There was going to be a surprise reveal at the end of the show over here that it was going to be Union Hospitality Stadium. But
Morning Voice Arena, you know.
Right. Bustos, you know. Arena over here.
Maverick King of Clubs has a good ring to it.
There you go.
Right.
See?
Country shows could happen all the time. Midland is playing over there actually on April 25th.
Yeah.
You know, excited to have that local act coming back to Tucson over here. But who can afford to do that, right? Like when you think of local businesses, you know, like if this isn't HSL Properties or Nova Home Loans or something, these are like the biggest companies we have in Tucson. These
Mr.
Are the,
Car Wash is a national corporation.
Right. Mr. Car.
Based here.
Yeah, it could be Mr. Car Wash Arena in some capacity, right? Mattress Firm is coming in over here on text, perhaps. Like, who could possibly go out?
Mattress Firm has joined the chat.
Yes, right? Who could possibly go out there and pay that kind of money to rename the Tucson Arena? And would it be worth it for you in some capacity to do so? We're staring down the barrel of both Tucson Arena and Arizona Stadium being renamed, and even McHale is not off the table right now. The university's got to figure out a way to pay the players an additional $20.5 million a year on that House versus NCAA settlement. And as such, like, what are the arena naming rights worth? Well, according to the Rio Nuevo agenda, this is worth about $2 million a year. And we should get that drop this afternoon. So I am really excited to find out who and what that name might be, because there really just aren't a lot of local businesses that could afford to stroke that check in some capacity. I'm looking at you, Ray Flores. I know you're out there somewhere in the Charo versus Christy Simone would say.
Maybe. The Lucky Wishbone Arena.
Josh Jacobson, where are you? Lucky Wishbone Arena, Arizona Sunland Food Stadium. I can see that one's got a great ring to it.
They'd right? have the ham bones, and they could be the ham bone Zamboni, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. But this is the stadium, of course, where the Tucson Roadrunners play, and we have Bob Hoffman and you know, Roadrunners president on quite regularly. They're wrapping up their season as well, too. In just 3 weeks at the end of April, we've got the Tucson Sugar Skulls play there as well, too, and a local ownership group with Kevin Guy and Ali Farhang that help put that one on. And so there are local concerts as well, too. You know, some decent-sized names come play this 8,000-10,000 person arena in some capacity. But who locally else could afford to write a $2 million check to rename the TCC in some capacity? You, my listeners, are going to find out just a little later this afternoon. We got a quick call in there, Matt?
Charles?
We're going to Charles Heller on line one.
Yeah, I think the city of Tucson could pony up and rename it Pancho Villa Stadium, and so it'd be in line with Tucson's city council's values. But I want to encourage people to go to Mr. Car Wash and get their car washed and offer to pay cash.
Can you not pay cash with that one? I'm guessing this is an inside statement over here, Charles.
They do not accept cash, but if enough people go there and offer them cash and then drive away to another car wash that does accept cash, like Octopus, although I'm not sure there are any of them left anymore, or go to a self-serve, which, by the way, still takes cash, and supports the American currency, I think if enough people do that and they see themselves losing business from it, or they could gain business from taking cash, that they might consider becoming Americans again.
Without a doubt, an excellent suggestion from Mr. Charles Heller over there. Mr. Car Wash Stadium coming up. We're going to get the drop right after that Rio Nuevo meeting, so stay tuned for that one. I'll bring that one up for you guys next week, and we'll have a great talk about it. It has been an amazing Wednesday morning. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday with us. Mr. Justin Harris, thank you for joining us on The Morning Voice.
Thanks, Grant. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
Enjoy that game tomorrow, 6:39 p.m., the University of Arizona against the Duke Blue Devils. I'll be watching. You'll be watching. We'll break it all down for you next week on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. Kathleen Wynn coming up after the break.